Hi, my name is Matej Cepin. I come from Slovenia, and this is the 61st episode of the Burning Bush podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to inspire you with the stories of people who are already living their vocation, so that you too may discover burning bushes within you and courageously step onto a new path. This podcast is usually in Slovene, and the guests come from Slovene backgrounds. This episode is actually the only one in English so far. It was recorded during the European Youth Meeting in Ljubljana, Slovenia, which took place on the occasion of the new year 2024 and brought together almost 5,000 young people from Europe and beyond. Brother Emil of Teze is, I hope I can say this, my longtime friend and companion when I do the spiritual exercises in silence in Teze. We met for the first time in 2000 during my very first silence, which still has an important meaning in my life. Even then, Brother Emil surprised me with his ability to listen, to give the right words, and above all, with his ability to point to God in my life. I can say that he was one of my most important burning bushes through which God spoke to me. Therefore, when he came to Ljubljana, I just had to satisfy my curiosity about what were his burning bushes and how he responded to them. For the international audience, let me tell you a few more facts about myself. I'm a husband and father of 6 children living in Ljubljana. I work as a trainer and facilitator in the field of personal growth and in organizational development. And I also work as a director of Social Academy, a non-profit organization where we strive to help everyone discover their full potential and realize it as responsible citizens. For Slovenian listeners, I will also publish a Slovenian summary of this episode, but it will certainly not contain everything what this episode has to offer. So if your knowledge of English is sufficient, listen to this one. If not, wait some more days for the Slovenian version. And now, let's get into action.
Že veš, kaj je tvoj edinstven prispevek k boljšemu svetu in kako ga udejanjiti? V podcastu Goreči grm razkrivamo močne zgodbe tistih, ki že živijo svoje poslanstvo, zato da lahko ti najdeš navdih, prepoznaš svoje goreče grme in pogumno stopiš na novo pot.
Hello, Emil. Welcome to the Burning Bush podcast.
Hello, Matej. Thank you very much.
And not only to the podcast, welcome to Ljubljana.
Thank you.
It's your third day here in Ljubljana in this round.
Yes.
But it's not your first visit, actually, no?
No, I was once, very briefly, in 2008, just after the meeting we had in Zagreb.
And can you tell me now the most difficult question? What are your first two or three impressions about Ljubljana after 2-3 days?
Well, when I was here the first time, I remember the beauty of the cathedral, of the prayer we had in the cathedral, where everything seemed to be in place. Everything seemed to be in the proper place. There was a kind of harmony, I remember. And I was looking forward to coming back to Ljubljana because I knew it was a place where there was a lot of art and a great sense of beauty and harmony. And that's what was confirmed on this visit. Since the very first moment, already the trip here to come, we took the train from Basel to Ljubljana, and it was a beautiful trip to see such beauty in the mountains.
This way from Teze or from Lyon to Ljubljana through Switzerland was very beautiful also for me when I traveled there.
Yeah, and so that was, I would say it was more of a confirmation of the place of beauty.
And also through Geneva, no?
And so we went through Basel this time.
We went through Basel this time.
Yeah. Then Basel, then we went to most of, big part of Austria.
Yeah.
And then we went to Villach. And
tell me, if you say we, how do you, Teze brothers, travel usually to such meetings?
So there was a big group that went by bus on Christmas night after the Christmas Eucharist. About 35, 40 brothers left on a bus. And then there was a small group of brothers, of which I was part, that left on the 26th of December. They were brothers that were older. And so we planned to stop in Basel for a prayer in the evening with some friends in Basel. And so we stopped on the evening of the 26th. And the morning of the 27th, at 7 o'clock in the morning, we left and we traveled all day until 8:30 in the evening. wow. by train to yeah. come to Ljubljana. So we were, when I say we, it means eight brothers, actually.
Eight brothers by train, 35 by bus.
Yeah.
And what were your actually very important tasks on the 25th and 26th that you couldn't join the bus?
Actually, it was not so much related to tasks. It was more related to the fact that some brothers could not go on the bus at night.
And so
since there was already a trip by train, I was asked if I wanted to join them. Mm-hmm. And so I was happy to accept it. We didn't have to be here early. Some brothers had to be here for the preparation of the mm-hmm. welcome on the 26th. I did not have to be, so I was able to come. One of the things that decided that I could come on the 27th was that.
And tell me, what are actually, in general, your roles in TZ? I know that you are brothers, and it's in a good brotherhood, roles are not strictly divided, what is your position? Yeah. Not position, not title, but your obligations, let's say.
Well, I've been there already a long time, so maybe I think 48 years I've been in TZ, and so I have done a number of things over the years. Some things very big contrast. For many years, I took care of the House of Silence.
Mm-hmm. So
I welcomed all the young men wanting to do a Week of Silence.
And but this was in previous millennium, right?
Yes. This was at the end of the 70s, early 80s. For 10 years, maybe I did that.
May I ask, how old are you for the listeners
now
to understand?
I'm just over 67.
Wow.
So I was born in 1956, and I came to TZ a long time ago as a young man in 1974, and then I came back in 75. So I've been a long time. And so my work has varied. Mm-hmm. So after doing the House of Silence, I did something very, you could say, almost at the other extreme. I took care of media. Mm-hmm. I took care of media as a contact with
other
journalists.
Other extreme, that's great.
So lots of talking.
Because just today, the pilgrims in Ljubljana had a topic, what is the balance between being alone and being with others, you did both ends of this balance. You did both silence, many weeks in silence and many weeks in media.
Yeah, so it's never a full-time job because I always did Bible introductions and I always spoke with people who wanted to talk more personally. But media was interesting because it allowed me to meet many good people from all over the world, many journalists, and to sense sometimes that people who are often judged very harshly, that there's sometimes a lot of goodness in them also. And I met all kinds of people, of course, but I met people also who are very good.
I would like to jump now because I think I've got inspired by your answer. How do you find this balance between being by yourself, being alone, being in silence on one side, and being together with others? Because I think that we in Slovenia here, people of my age and a little bit younger and older, actually we usually go to one or the other extreme. If you are a good person, you have a lot of things to do and you are always in contacts. And then if you are maybe mentally a little bit ill, you are in depression, you are alone, a lot of Catholics also find themselves time for silence, but not every day maybe, maybe some days together. How do you find this balance? Because in TZ you could every day see more than 1,000 people.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's a question we are ever finished answering. I think it remains something that we always search for a balance. And so sometimes you notice that some periods of my life were very full of many, many meetings and many people and many urgent tasks. And there are moments where there was not so full. I had more time for. I actually found it rather difficult when life became too full. And I decided at one point I don't want to live always so busy, and I enjoyed having at least one walk every day, a half hour walk, or if possible a little bit longer. But it's a balance, and I don't think the brothers find answers more easily than anybody else. We are also looking for answers, but we know that if we are just busy, it's not going to be good. We're not going to be able to listen properly to people. Our conversations will be more superficial if we have no time alone.
But does they actually, in itself, in the core brand of TZ, actually, there are both these elements. No, in the core brand of TZ is silence three times a day, and in the core brand of TZ is meeting each other.
Yeah, we do. You're right. Even if it's very busy, there is always the three prayers a day. There is always the silence. So that's a very fundamental part of our life. But the meeting together, yes, we have many opportunities, of course, to be together for the prayer, for the meals, for the. But the quality of the time we have together is often influenced by our capacity to, yeah, to live in a spirit of silence, to live in a spirit of inner silence, not outer silence always, but inner silence, and that is never a once and for all victory. No, it's something that you are always searching to grow in this direction, and that's I think is the case for the brothers also.
Can you tell me? Have you ever been on that side of spectrum where you had too much silence and you wanted to go to somebody? Because usually people are on that side of the spectrum, that they have too many contacts and they want more silence. But did you ever have the opposite problem?
Well, I think sometimes when you have a life very full of meetings and words and activity, you look forward to moments of solitude, and that is a good thing. I mean, it's solitude is supposed to be a good thing. No? Yeah. You're supposed to look at it as something. Ah, I will do something nice now. I will go for a walk. I will look at nature. I will listen to music. I will read a good book. No, and so when solitude is a project that has a positive aim, it's a good thing.
If it's intentional.
It's intentional. When it becomes something, it's just because no one is there. No, I'm alone because I didn't make any plans and I don't have any friends around me. Then it's solitude becomes heavy, no? And it becomes empty, I think.
Yeah, you are right. Actually, my generation usually doesn't have solitude because they have children, they have families, but a lot of older people in our time.
Right.
Are on the other side of that spectrum.
I think the challenge is today, I think, is because I noticed this a lot in my life, is we are more tired nervously because we are communicating a lot. We are, we're honestly getting messages, answering, we're doing two or three things at the same time. There's traffic, and our ambition is bigger. Also, we want to do more because we have the technology to help us do more. And so we are more tired nervously. And so when you're more tired nervously, sometimes you just want to withdraw for a while, no? Which is legitimate, no? It's legitimate, but at the same time, you can exaggerate that direction. No? You can go
as well.
You can exaggerate the withdrawal. And sometimes, you know, when you say, I'm tired, but I think it would be a good thing to go to this meeting. I think it would be a good thing to go to this prayer. I think it would be a good thing. It's worth listening to that little voice. That says
sometimes solitude is also the comfort zone, no?
Yeah, sometimes it's also saying, yes, it's worth going to something where you will meet good people and search together and be the joy of being together. So it's worth listening to that little voice, no?
Yeah.
Sometimes the little voice says, take some time now for yourself, no? And it's good to listen to that, huh? But sometimes the little voice says, there is life also in meeting others.
Yeah.
So you try to listen to that
it's
as well.
It's a good idea to always check on which part of the spectrum you are, because usually you are not in balance, no?
I mean,
not you, everybody.
And for everyone, there is the struggle, of course, to live. Life is not always a struggle. Life is sometimes just a wonderful thing, but sometimes it's a struggle because we know we have responsibility. Yeah. If you are a father, if you are a mother, you know that you don't choose your timetable all the time. Yeah. No, you're responding to urgencies. And so what is an urgency? Emergency. And so, but amongst sometimes we don't have that so much. No, we don't have so many emergencies except sometimes at Teze with the welcome. But so you are able to plan a little bit more. And it's good always to listen, I think, to what you feel that God is telling you now, calling you to growth, to grow, to meet people.
Why I'm speaking so much about silence is because it's our common topic. The story goes like this, that in the year 2000, I came to Teze first time to the silence. I was in Teze already before many times, but in the year 2000, and you were delivered to me as my accompanier. There was some brother Emil. Okay, no problem. That was great, and it was really a nice experience to share with you every second day my thoughts, my inspirations, and this was a very fruitful silence. And then I was in around 7 or 8 silences after that, and you were always in Teze. You are usually traveling 1/4 of year or something, but always when I came to Teze, you were there waiting for me. Yeah. I don't know how.
Probably because you came in the summer. Probably.
Yeah, but not always. No, I also came 1st of May. But you were always there, and I feel it's such a blessing that I always in the silence had you as a, how do you say, accompanier?
Accompany you. Yeah, I was happy to do that, of course. It's one of the joys of Teze is to listen to people to accompany them. And Brother Roger, our one who started Teze, and he always said, we want to be people who listen and accompany. Mm. We don't want to be pretend that we are spiritual masters or something, but to listen, to accompany. And today I think we see the wisdom of these words, no? Because it's easy to people to take their ideas for the ideas of God. And it's much better to listen together, no? To listen together to God.
Yeah, tell me this. I know in theory that listening is very important. I know that without listening, there is no dialogue. But for you, listening is, let's say it's a habit for you, Teze brothers. Are you really growing through listening, or do you sometimes get tired of listening? You know, because I know that you want to show us that through listening we are growing together, but is it really? I mean, do you, how much, there will be many questions now. How much time can you listen attentively, you personally, and when do you just pretend to listen then?
Well, actually, when I was very, very young person and I met Teze the first time, I was very struck by the use of the word to listen, the verb to listen, because the person who was talking said, actually, we don't normally listen, we let the words come to us, but we're already preparing an answer inside, no? So we're not really receiving. And so I felt that call at a very young age to try to understand more about what listening is. And I must say, it continues. I still try to understand. Sometimes I think, I didn't listen enough, no?
Do you have some, let's say, advices to be a better listener? What, your personal, of course, everybody has his own pathway, but still, what were your biggest lectures after you found Teze in listening? What were your biggest?
Well, I think there are times when maybe we are better listeners, but better listeners, and maybe there are moments where we are not able to listen so well because there are too many things in our head, too many concerns. That's what I was saying earlier about if our life is too busy, sometimes we're not very good listeners because we are tired, and we are tired and there are too many words already. So I often felt the need to say, when you take time to be alone, half an hour, 1 hour to go for a walk, you're doing it not selfishly. No? You're doing it also to be a better listener, a better listener. And so I feel there's a lot there to learn. So sometimes you're not very proud of the fact that you are not a good listener. And so you say, I missed something there. And other times, maybe you say, it was a wonderful experience to listen, not to this person. And you hear that it was important for them. Or I know people like that who discovered faith because someone listened to them. Some people had a very violent past, sometimes very difficult past. They said, Why do you listen? Why do you listen? No? You're not paid for this. You're not. Why is it important for you to listen? And so I think that's it's important. So so we're not always good listeners, but we learn. Sometimes we learn from our failures. We learn from our past experiences. And sometimes maybe when you study philosophy or theology, you think, I will speak about what I read. I will speak about, and maybe there are moments when it's good to do that, but also it's good also to say, am I leaving enough space for the people to express their feelings, their heart, their thoughts?
It's so counterintuitive, you know, because our priests and also famous lay people, of course, care to always have to tell something, not to listen. And you say that now, not only through telling, but through listening, faith comes, no?
Yeah, and I think what lots of people, you know, we live in a period where faith is not easy. There are many doubts about oneself sometimes also, you know, my weak faith, my little understanding. And so when you're listening, you are bringing a kind of confirmation to people, no? You say, this is interesting. No, God is obviously, you don't maybe say it, but you let people understand that you see God, no? In their attempt.
In their
attempt. You don't have to say this explicitly because it doesn't help sometimes.
But it happens subconsciously, actually. No?
Yeah, and people realize, you know, my story, maybe my story is important. No, everyone of us has a story. No?
Yeah.
But when you have been surrounded by people who say your story is not interesting, you start to doubt. And that's one of the great things. I think Brother Roger in Teze had this great gift of making people feel their story was important. You could be the most humble person, but he felt, there's something beautiful in this person's story. He had this quote that he liked a lot that I'm not sure that he quoted always accurately, but it's something that Pope Paul said once when he said, every human being is sacred for God. Mm-hmm. Every human being is sacred by the wound of their wounded innocence of their childhood. Mm-hmm. By the wounded innocence of their childhood, every human being is sacred for mm-hmm. God. And so when we're listening to someone, we know that we are all, of course, wounded. All of us are wounded by being a human being, by being a limited human being. No, there's a wound also to that. But somehow that is even makes us even maybe more valuable, more valuable in the sight of God.
Can you tell me honestly, is it more difficult for you to talk or to listen?
It maybe depends on the moment. It maybe depends on the moment. Talking sometimes is also a good experience because there are some things you think you see clearly in a question. You're happy mm-hmm. to share something that you gain some insight, some understanding in, and so you want to share it. Listening sometimes is maybe more difficult because you have to refrain. You have to say, oh, stop for a moment. No, stop mm-hmm. for a moment. They mm-hmm. say sometimes we have two ears and one mouth. No, yes. it means we must listen more than we think. No?
Yes.
And so sometimes you have to make a more conscious decision to say, no, now I'm going to be quiet to try to listen to what the other mm-hmm. person says. No, it's maybe more natural sometimes to keep talking.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's go to the most interesting part of the story, you and Teze. So how does somebody become a monk in Teze? How did it happen to you? Okay, I'm 47, yeah. So you came to Teze, or you became the brother
yeah.
1 year before I was born.
Yeah.
What was it, 75?
76, I became a brother, and 75 I went to Teze for 1 year.
But this was the first visit.
74 was the first visit.
74. Yeah. And it was the visit from Canada?
Yes, I was.
You are the, 11th of 12 children? Or
12th of 13 12th children.
Of 13. Yeah. Can you tell me about your childhood first and then we continue?
Yeah.
How was it?
Yeah. Well, I was born in a fairly remote, isolated part of Canada. It's Ontario. Uh-huh. The capital is Toronto. But my town is 700 kilometers north of Toronto.
Wow.
So a town that did not exist until 1912. It was started in 1912. It's a mining town, gold mines, and copper mines. And so I was born there in a French-Canadian family mm-hmm. With French roots. Mm-hmm. Was the 12th child. So I already had this experience of being surrounded by lots of people.
Yeah.
But not all of us were always together, because there's 20 years difference between the oldest and the youngest. And so they not all were at the same home. And it was a different period of history in those days. And it's quite sad to say it. No, in those days, girls did not study. Girls mm-hmm. did not study. So you could be the most bright girl, the brightest girl of the class, the brightest person in the family. No? But if you were a girl, you had to work to help your mother. No?
So you even stopped, not in Canada.
Yeah, so you stopped school at 14. This is, I'm talking about the 1940s and 50s now. No, and so it was the case for one of my sisters. She was the brightest person in class. And when she stopped school at 14 years old, the teachers were crying, no? Because they knew she was the brightest child. No?
Wow.
And so, but you had to help. You had to help financially. You had to help your. And so she stopped. And then only later, when she was married and after she had raised her own children, she went back to school and studied at university and did wonderfully well. But that's the type of family I was born in, many children. There were two languages in the family.
Material things?
It was a simple life. We had a garden. We had a big garden, so we could grow a lot of our own vegetables, which helped because my father did not have a big salary. So it was helpful to have a big garden. So we all learned how to work as children and to help. So my work was sometimes in the garden. Especially my work was to take in the wood at night for the heating in the winter. We had long winters. It's northern Ontario. So we cut the wood. We had no other source of heating but the wood. Heating that, so we had to cut the wood.
In Teze, people are often speaking about fire, about light. Yeah. So you have this from early childhood.
Yeah, early childhood. So my work was every night to take in the wood that would be for the night and the next morning, and next day, and then to make what we call kindling. Kindling. So it's kindling is you take an axe and you cut the wood in small pieces to start the fire.
Yeah.
And so I used to do this, and sometimes since I was a boy and I liked to play, I used to wait until it was quite dark. Uh-huh. And so I still have a scar on my thumb when I was cutting in the dark,
oh.
the little pieces of wood. And then we would start, my father would get up at 5 a.m. to start the fire. And so we would have maybe 2 or 3 hours without fire.
Mm.
2 or 3 hours, maybe the last piece of wood. We would get up at 2 or 3 a.m. But at 5, it was no fire. And it was minus 30, minus 40.
So oh, so very, north, very yeah, cold. Of course.
So that's my surroundings. And it was far from the town. Far from the town, it was 10 kilometers from the town. And so the school board would provide transportation for us, but it means that I lived a lot in the forest and went for long walks in the forest and did a lot of things in the woods when I was younger. That was my youth. When I was 17, there was a Teze meeting, a Teze weekend in my hometown.
Wow.
And
this town, your home village, or
yeah.
this far from the town?
It's home village, yeah, Timmins. It's a small town, but it's still 30,000 people.
Uh-huh.
And someone gave my name to go to this weekend. I was only 17, but someone said it will interest Emil. And so I went out of curiosity. I had no idea what Teze was. And
which year was this? This was... Which year?
January 1974. So it'll be 50 years.
So this was the first
next,
already.
Next month it'll be 50 years. Yeah,
yeah
50
yeah, yeah.
years.
Wow.
And so I went, and what struck me the most, I think your program is called Burning Bush.
No? Yes.
And I think that burning bush for me was discovering what it means that Christ is risen.
Uh-huh.
Christ is risen, that the resurrection is real. It's not just words, that life has overcome death. And therefore... joy has a foundation.
But this was not on the cognitive level, because on cognitive level you knew it. No,
yeah.
What was
yeah.
it? What kind of feelings was it?
Yeah, yeah. It was not not because I had read something, but it was. I woke up one morning during this weekend, maybe the last morning, and suddenly I realized what it meant. Christ is risen.
Uh-huh.
Christ is risen. It means when I had many friends who had been on retreats and I would see them very optimistic, very joyful. But my worry was that this joy was like a forced optimism.
Yes. No?
I was worried that... And
like communists said in that time in Slovenia,
maybe,
that religion is opium for
maybe,
people. No?
Maybe or forced or artificial.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, yeah.
and then when I think the resurrection, it made me realize... no, it's not a forced optimism. There's a foundation for joy.
Mm-hmm.
There's a foundation for joy. I didn't have the words to say it. I was 18,
yeah.
17, 18.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't have the words to say it.
But you were totally happy, or what was this feeling?
And it was certainly a form of happiness. I don't know. But it was a world opening up. No, it was the world of hope opening up to me and the world of...
Could people see this change in you already on the first day, or was it all only inner... joy.
Oh no, there was a change for sure. Yeah, because I, as a teenager, as a boy, I had been religious, but as a teenager, I wasn't really interested in religion. And so, it's only at this Teze meeting that I rediscovered my faith of my childhood, and then it was a conscious decision to go in this direction and to try to grow in that direction. And but not having words, when I came across a French poet, a very famous French poet, Paul Claudel, who was a Christian and not a man with an easy personality. He was often a difficult man, but he had wonderful ways of expressing things. Once he said, where there is the most joy, there is the most truth.
Mm-hmm.
Where there is the most joy, there is the most truth. And that was a little bit my experience. That's what I mean by resurrection. No, the greatest possible thing, or the thing we never even dared hope for, is what God offers us. And so that was the beginning. Of course, if you have that experience, you want to know more. So I heard, there's another Teze weekend next month. And so I traveled a long ways to go to this in New York State, where I first met two brothers that were traveling. And then...
You traveled the whole continent.
Well, it wasn't the whole continent, but it was still like 1,000 miles or something.
Yes.
And so, and then a sister, a religious sister who was kind of in Northern Ontario, who is still alive today, who still has this great love for young people. She's 85 now, but then she was maybe 35. She said, I'm going to Teze with a group of Canadians. I want you to come. So I went that summer of 1974.
How could you afford it if you were not the richest family?
This is why the sister was so helpful, because she said, I'm going to make it a cultural trip. to Europe, and the government of Canada in those days would subsidize. They would give a grant for a cultural trip. So
you actually got public money for your first visit to Taizé.
Yes, but it wasn't only Taizé. It was a visit to France. So in Switzerland, and so it was French culture, but the aim was
connected to the French culture to your roots.
So the aim was Taizé, it was presented in such a way that we could benefit from a grant. So it wasn't expensive.
This is how I work with my projects in my NGO. You've got aim and you've got all the paper around your aim.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how we went to Taizé for the first time in July 1974.
And what happened then? What happened on that week, actually?
Yeah, actually, it was a very peaceful week. Nothing exceptional happened. It was peaceful. I liked Taizé, but I felt I already knew Taizé. I didn't really have to discover Taizé.
You discovered it a lot already in Canada, and you actually... It was nothing so new.
Nothing so new, but it was interesting to talk with one of the brothers, and it was interesting to, of course, I didn't really talk with Brother Roger in 1974, but I knew it was written many interesting things, so I started to read his writings, and I used to like his journal. Now we are publishing again in English, his journals.
Wow.
And the journal, you know, diary, you publish what you... So there are texts that are more... theoretical, spiritual, which are good also, but then you see how a man tries to live every day, sometimes with failures, with hostility, with people who don't want you to succeed, who want you to fail, and how you keep peace. How do you keep peace when you are surrounded?
He wrote a journal,
and he published it for many years. He published regularly, and so that struck me very much. The ability to try to translate into real life.
No? So he was the influencer of the 70s.
Yeah, very much.
I think what people now do on Instagram, he wrote.
Yeah, I think so. I think he had the courage to share and to share also the things that were not always easy to share. No, some of his own sense of failure, sometimes his own sense of being inadequate, not up to the task. And I think when someone does that, he is kind of giving you permission to be you. Some people do that. They give you permission to be who you are. You can be you. You can have failures also. You can also be searching and not always sure of everything and groping. And so that, I thought Brother Roger's writings were extremely helpful. And so I stayed a week. I went back to Canada. I finished 1 year of study in grade 13, we would say in Canada. So it's 1 year after high school, I suppose. And then I felt that the most important thing at that time in my life was to find out what God wanted from me. And so I had no idea what that was. So I said, maybe I should go to Taizé for 1 year. Go to Taizé for 1 year just to be available, to pray three times a day, to have some type of activity that will be connected to the gospel.
You wanted to devote this year to God, to find together with him what he wants from you.
And I kind of felt that Taizé might be a good place, but I had not thought about being a brother at Taizé. I thought just Taizé would be a place.
Taizé was a tool for finding out your mission.
And so the surprise was that after about 3 months, from maybe September to December 75, after 3 months, I felt suddenly there's more here than just a place to be open to a question. It's maybe there's an answer also in the lifestyle of the brothers. And I tried to become open to the possibility of...
You've been searching the question, but you got the answer, actually.
Slowly.
You saw Taizé as a place to ask questions, but actually Taizé itself was your answer.
It was, in a way. But it also meant changing my plans. For me, it was very clear. I was there for 1 year, one university year. And so when I realized that maybe there is a life here for me, maybe it's a call from God even, I realized I cannot control things here. I have to let go. And that's never altogether easy, not to let go of your own plans. And so I managed. I think at one point it was given to me. I don't think it's I managed, but it was given to me to let go, to surrender, if you like.
Yeah.
And then there's a joy also.
For example, what dreams of family or...
Or even just career. Being in control. Even just being in control, saying, this is going to last 1 year, this is going to last 6 months, this is going to last... But so that suddenly, I don't know how long it will take to see clearly. Maybe I have to listen for 1 year, maybe it'll be 2 years, And so, but after a few months, I started to speak with one of the brothers who had a lot of wisdom, who had accompanied many young men thinking about vocation. And I went through ups and downs, and that was maybe from February to... August, I entered in August 1976. And
at that time, I was 3 months old.
Yeah, okay, that's when I entered and became a brother. And so it was a, it still is a journey. It was still is a journey, but it was a journey also to discover a little bit more about yourself. To I can't say that I knew myself all that very well. When you are from a big family, there are things you. I think a big family is a wonderful thing. No, it's a wonderful thing. It's mostly positive, but there are also some negative things of being from a big family. So there's not as much, maybe, room for personal expression, mm-hmm. and because your parents are so busy, everyone mm-hmm. is so busy, and you're the youngest, you're competing for attention. You don't always have much much place, and so it was an experience where I could discover more about myself, more about the Gospels. I didn't really know much about the Gospels, and that became something very important for me too. Mm-hmm. A Christianity where there's room for understanding, room for your brain, room for your for thought, and so that was very stimulating for me.
Mm-hmm. 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 To become, actually, to make your identity more clear, or what?
My identity, but also to.
I mean, being the 12th or the 13th, sometimes. Blurs your identity a little bit, or
sure, because you're among the last, and I think of course, Brother Roger and the other brothers, they were, as I said earlier, they were very good at helping someone realize their value. No, mm-hmm. their value. You have something to give. You have something to contribute. And I think today, when we met earlier at the workshop on synodality, you were doing with many people, mm-hmm. there was this idea that you discover something as you face a need or a challenge, no? Mm-hmm. You discover that there are resources, that there are people, mm-hmm. and that was a little of my experience also, that mm-hmm. that life helped me discover things that I like to do and I never thought I would be doing, and Brother Roger was very good at believing in people. No, mm-hmm. you didn't believe in yourself so much, but he helped you believe in you and encourage you to, and so that I think helped me a lot.
Can you tell a story or two how it happened? For example, you had doubts of something, mm-hmm. and then he encouraged you to do something, or how? Can you please tell one or two interactions of you with him which confirmed you in your faith or courage? Or
yeah. Well, I think, of course, there were some things like I never imagined I would do this work with. Media with words. I had two languages in my family, French and English. And so when you have two languages, it's not always easy because you don't know which language you prefer. Mm-hmm. You don't know which is your native language. You don't really have one native language, you know, mm-hmm. mixture. And so I always was intimidated a little bit by these Parisian people who could talk so well, no? And mm-hmm. they could speak like books and have talk about 1,000 ideas in a minute. And I was not like that. No, I was from, and so, but I was suddenly asked to go meet journalists, and I was mm-hmm. Parachuted in this company of.
You actually had your image that you are not a good speaker.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I could speak publicly. If I prepare, but then you have to improvise.
It's
a very different story. No, it's a very different story.
Because in media you have to improvise.
And so this was a discovery for me, and it took me a long time to start to feel a tiny bit comfortable.
But how did Brother Roger help you with this, for example? Was it some specific or was just general believing in you?
I think it was believing in brother, believing in me, believing in, and so that helps. I think when someone confirms again and again and again, no, it's that you are bringing something, and so then I don't know what else. There was the life of prayer. My first Christmas liturgy, the 4 weeks before Christmas, Advent. I was the first time in 1975, was my first time from being far from Canada, far from my family. I thought, probably there will be some loneliness. No? Mm-hmm. And I was surprised at the beauty of the prayer together at mm-hmm. Christmas, the 4 weeks before what we call Advent. There is this strong longing, we say mm-hmm. desire for mm-hmm. God. No, you're expressing the creation, the cosmos, the mm-hmm. people. Each individual, you can express this deep, deep longing for God. No, we actually don't always know what we desire. Mm-hmm. We don't know. We think we want this or success or this, or, but actually we are longing for God. No, and
usually and, we are banal. Is it the right word in our expectations? Yeah, no, yeah, but yeah, there is.
But there is something deeper than this.
Yeah. Banal. I'm thirsty, but I don't know of what.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think the liturgy for me helped a lot. No, the prayer in the church, that is that first Advent. I was surprised. There is something here that is a treasure. No, there's something here that is a treasure, and that I think that helped me a lot also. And talking, of course, with a brother regularly is something that helped me also. That's invaluable, no, to have the possibility to speak about sometimes the good things, but sometimes also about the more challenging things that you're going through.
What were the biggest actually changes, let's say structural changes? You came from a big family and then you came to a big brotherhood, but there were still some differences which maybe were difficult to adapt to.
Well, I think the European mentality was very different from the North American mentality. No, because
what's the difference, actually?
Well, the French-Canadian mentality is generally fairly straightforward, fairly direct. And so we were the new world. We say the new world, no?
Yeah.
And so it's fairly direct. And there's not so much this idea of classes, no?
French is the opposite, no?
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. Probably. And so France has, of course, there's a class consciousness, no? There are people who are born in rich families. There are people born in aristocratic families.
Yeah,
there are
people
born in working classes. And we don't have this.
Trying to tell it in beautiful words, maybe in Balkans it's totally different,
Maybe just keeping your place also. If you're born in a certain family, you know your place. You know, this expression we say, to know your place. Huh? Mm-hmm. And so you don't go out of it. When you're North American, you don't think like that. No, mm-hmm. You're North American, you think we're all equal. No, we all have potential.
Yeah,
maybe it has not been developed, but we're all potential. So I was quite naive about all of this when I started to live at Taizé. And of course, there's something good about not knowing, about being naive, because you do things that maybe you wouldn't do otherwise. You'd be too intimidated if you knew more about history, if you knew more about how it's supposed to be done. Mm-hmm. But I think the French mentality, it took me maybe 3 or 4 years to start to understand the French mentality. I used to think that Parisians were very cold. You go to Paris, sometimes you're not served in the right way or proper way. And then I realized, no, there's actually something positive going on. Mm-hmm. People don't serve you well if you don't first say hello to them. No, bonjour. And I noticed this is a big difference. If you treat people like people, then they answer in a different way. And so it was a learning process for me to understand that in what is more reserved, we say reserved when people are not immediately warm, no?
Yeah.
There is actually a kind of wisdom sometimes, no?
Yeah.
Kind of wisdom where they get to know you and they respect your freedom and you want to go further, okay, I will go further. No? And so in Canada, there's people are generally warm right away. Right away. But it's not always good because someone said, they open their arms to everyone, but they close them on no one. Which is a little bit exaggeration. There are some people who know how to close their arms. But I also like the idea that it took me 3 or 4 years to discover that, you respect people's freedom, you grow little by little, and then you are friends forever. And the French have a great sense of friendship that I admired very much.
You said one very interesting sentence that you know where your place is. Did you get sometimes a place where you felt, disappointed or, this is not my place, come on, why are you putting me there?
Well, not really. No, not really. I didn't have that experience very much. No, it was, on the contrary, I was always more
valued
impressed than the, yes. Sometimes more impressed by what was asked than I didn't feel so much being put down, but more called to develop my gifts. So a theology, I started to discover a love for theology when I was fairly young, for reading, and I was encouraged to do that. And so that brought me a lot, I think, later on in life. And I was able to do some, to go deeper in certain themes and to write a little bit. And so this was important for me and remains important, I think.
You did quite a big, long path in theology.
And I was thinking about this day. Some famous French Jesuit once said, I don't know if your listeners will know this word, but we say fideism. No, fideism, where there's no room for intelligence, you just believe. No room for understanding, you just believe. No, they say it's the grave digger of faith. the grave digger of faith. No, it means we need, our minds need to participate. We need to understand. It doesn't mean we understand everything, but we need to participate. And our minds need to participate. And that was important for me, I think, to start to understand that. And that passing on something, this I studied when I did a book on Conga, and I read a lot of Yves Conga, who's the famous French Dominican theologian, and then I read a lot of de Lubac, who was a famous Jesuit, French Jesuit. Both were great pioneers of the Second Vatican Council, both great experts, great contributors to the texts of the Council. I realized that, repetition, just to repeat what you received, is not going to guarantee that you are passing it on.
Yeah.
No? So there's a need to be creative. And of course, I admired this very much in Brother Roger. Brother Roger had a great sense of the Christian tradition and a great sense that tradition is passed on only if you are creative.
Yeah.
If you are creative. And so that had a profound influence on me.
Yeah, what I admire in Teze is this creativity, how to make new things which still fit into...
I think Brother Roger had that freedom, and at the same time he had strong roots. Strong roots in the Christian faith and scripture. So it was not just creativity to do something new for doing something new, but it was creativity coming from a strong rootedness.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Brother Roger was probably your second father, or?
Oh, in a way, I suppose. Father, mother. He was a very special person. He was not a spiritual director. He didn't want to play that role. He didn't want to pretend that to be the spiritual director. He would more be someone to encourage you.
Tell me how it is when this second father, let's say, it's in 2005 passed away, and then this change of leader.
Yep.
We are not speaking here concretely about Brother Alois or Brother Matthew now, who is the third leader. But how is this when this strong person passes away? Which difficulties come there? And maybe are there some things which you become more in freedom or something?
Yeah, I thought a lot about that question sometimes, and my conclusion was more that we have to approach it more by the angle of gratitude, gratefulness.
Mm-hmm.
No? You are grateful for everything you received for 10, 20, 30 years from someone. I knew Brother Roger. I lived with him for 30 years almost.
Yes.
And so I think the proper angle for me was to say, I should be grateful for everything. Of course, I'm going to miss going to miss him because he's no longer there, and that confirmation is not going to be there in the same way. And I feel it, no? But the right take on this, the right approach to it is not regret, but it's more gratefulness for what was given.
You know what I'm trying to ask you is, if you have a father, if you have a strong personality, then you rely on it, no? But then it goes.
Yeah.
And is there some crisis sociologically? Because, then Brother Alois was one of us. He is the leader, or you become... I think that all the other brothers have to take more responsibility there. Even if they don't become leaders, they have to take more responsibility. Now, our founding father is not here anymore. Does it happen, something like that?
I see. Maybe it would have been different if Brother Roger had died younger. But since Brother Roger died when he was very old, 90 years
and
old.
He didn't have a strong role anymore, actually.
And so in the last years of his life, we saw him much more dependent on the brothers. Yeah, yeah. No, and so until he was about 85, maybe a little bit less than 85, but not much less, he was aware of almost all the aspects of Tizé. Yeah. No, he was interested in all the aspects.
So you took responsibility even before his
death.
Yes,
and I think that helped the transition. Where we realized we needed. So, and then, of course, there's a different period when the founder of the community is no longer the one in charge, no longer alive. That you, of course, are entering into a different period of history. And so, the ones who come after are not going to pretend to be Brother Roger. They're going to have to be themselves. Otherwise, it won't work. You have to be yourself. You have to be. And so Alois did that. Now Brother Matthew. So I would approach it more from the angle of gratitude, not from the angle so much, this is missing now. It's more, you received something for 10, 20, 30 years that carried you, and be grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, because after Brother Alois went to position, I thought, actually I never said you this question, when Brother Roger died, he was the next one, no? But now Brother Alois didn't die, but you got the next one. What is actually your rule?
So the process is simply, it's explained just in a few lines in the small book that Brother Roger wrote in the 1950s, 1953 uh-huh. he published, called The Rule of Tese.
Uh-huh.
The Rule of Tese, and it's a very short
book. Yeah, you are really masters. Tese brothers, for me, you are really masters of simplicity. Not only in life, in walls, in tents, yeah. but also in words.
Well,
you use very simple words
yeah.
for everything, and yeah. you even use simple words for your rules.
You're right, but at the same time, Brother Roger was a writer.
Mm-hmm.
He was a gifted writer. He wrote a mm-hmm. very eloquent French, a very, very beautiful, very stylish French,
mm-hmm.
Especially in those years, 50s, 60s, 70s, mm-hmm. a little bit less in his old age. In his old age, mm-hmm. he was not as careful with the writing, mm-hmm. But until he was 75 or so, the books he published, the French was exquisite, was mm-hmm. really the French of a writer. It was, and so the Rule of Tese says that the prior, the one in charge of the community, appoints someone to continue after him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all it says. It doesn't say how long, doesn't say, mm-hmm. and doesn't say. And so Brother Alois was chosen by Brother Roger. Brother Roger was sick one day in South Africa. He thought he was having a heart attack. It was 1978. And Brother Alois was with him. Brother Alois was a very young brother. And he said, I was thinking about you for continuing. And Brother Alois said, it's impossible. I cannot do this. It's impossible. And Brother Roger said, no, it's possible. And it went on like this for 5 minutes. Possible, not possible, possible, not possible. And then the heart started to beat normally again. And Brother Roger lived another 20 years or 27 years, no? And then in 1998...
Did you know about this African
yes,
experience already from...
And not, I didn't know about it right away, but later on Brother Roger told me
mm-hmm.
That he was thinking of Alois. And
and
so it was not a surprise. And then he made a public announcement to the community in 1998, I remember.
Oh, already?
January 1998, I remember very clearly. He said, I think it's better that it be official now, and I want to know if there are any objections. So I was thinking of Alois, and so he
not
said,
publicly, but publicly to community.
To the community.
Okay,
it was kind of an official kind of announcement.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there were no objections, so everybody knew that it would be Alois, but Brother Roger continued to be responsible. And then January 2005 came, and Brother Roger was going to be 90 in 2005. So he said to the community, I think maybe Alois should start this year. I'm so old now.
No? Mm-hmm.
And so we thought it was normal. We were not surprised. We mm-hmm. thought it was normal. But then it was January 2005. Then it was February 2005. Then it was March. Then it was April. And nothing happened.
He just didn't start.
Yeah. So one of their older brothers said to Brother Roger, but you said it was this year. What month were you thinking about? No? And Brother Roger said, August would be a good month to start for Alois.
No? Wow.
And, of course, Brother Roger was killed on the 16th of August 2005. Wow. And that's when Alois started. He was at World Youth Day in Cologne, Germany. Mm-hmm. There was a phone call. Can you imagine a phone call? No? Phoning in Germany to say, Brother Roger.
Alois was not present in the church at that time.
He was at Cologne for World Youth Day. And so they got the call saying, so you can imagine what it was like for him. One young couple said, we can drive you to Tese. So they drove him all night by car.
Yeah.
And he arrived half an hour before morning prayer. He went to morning prayer. At the end of the morning prayer, he embraced all the brothers, and that's how he started to be the prior.
There was not so official as it was in the 3rd of December.
No. And so for Brother Matthew, who's now Brother Alois' successor, it was different because Brother Alois is still healthy, still good,
mm-hmm.
but he felt 18 years as prior was enough. Yeah. It was good to have new energy, new blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, for 3 or 4 years, he had been saying, I think now is the time to stop. And so he continued because there were some things he wanted to finish. But in January, he made kind of official announcement that he had chosen Matthew. He wanted to know also our reaction. He had asked us to suggest some names.
So it went much faster.
Yeah. And so it was announced. And then we said it will be in December. So he announced in January it will be in December. So 11 months later, it was it happened as a transition. We had to create a liturgy. We had to create
a for it.
And it was actually a very good experience for the
community. Is it an interesting task to create a new ceremony?
I think it was. I was only indirectly associated to it, but I think it was an interesting task.
I've been watching you over YouTube. So.
Yeah. It was an interesting task, I think, and I think people were very touched by it because you could sense that it was all about faith.
No?
Mm-hmm. It's not about strategy. It's not about, but it's all about faith. No, because no one is ever going to be equipped to say, I'm ready for this task. No, it's a question of faith.
Born leader.
Yeah, you are a poor man, you are a poor, but you have been entrusted with this responsibility, this service. No, it's a service, really. It's a service of unity and the community. And so I think it happened in a very beautiful way in early December of 2023.
If we go back to early times, when you came to Teze in 1974 and then 5 and 6, in which stage was Teze at that time? These young pilgrims already started, because for the listeners, we have to tell that at first it was not meant like this, no? At first it was just meant to be a peaceful community, and then just somebody discovered it and put it on Instagram. I'm joking now. And young people started to come.
Yes, you're right. It was not planned. So Brother Roger came in 1940, small village. It's really a small village. Yeah. Maybe counting the brothers, it's 100 people. So that's really small.
Yeah.
And then he came looking for a house in 1940, because he already had the idea that community is something we need for today. Mm-hmm. No, and so I was very struck recently. I had to speak in Canada, and I was speaking on the topic of individualism and community. And Brother Roger had written in 1944 a book that you cannot find anymore.
Wow.
It was called Introduction to Community Life.
Oh.
And he says in this introduction, he says his worry when he was a young man, early 20s, where are we going with individualism? Where are we going? And he said, I did not have faith when he was a very young adult. He had lost his faith for 2 years or so. He was like an agnostic. He was not an atheist, but he was like an agnostic.
Wow.
And so he says it in this introduction to the book. I was already thinking about community, even without faith.
Uh-huh.
But then I realized Christ is the source of this community. And so he was not alone. In the 1930s, there were many philosophers, a number of philosophers in France, Switzerland, Germany, maybe other countries, I don't know, who were thinking about this rise, this increase in individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And what is this going to produce? What is it? We're seeing it now. No? We're seeing what it produces.
Yeah, at that time
now.
It was not like
this. It
was
just the beginnings.
No?
Yeah. It was just the beginnings of it, but they were worried. And so that's what pushed him to come to Teze, to find a house where he could start a community. And then the community was going to be ecumenical, because that he felt was important, that the Christians give a visible sign of unity. Otherwise, they will not be very credible.
But his dream didn't come true until Second Vatican Council, no?
It started to be a little bit more a reality. But in the 40s, when he came, there was some enthusiasm from some churches, but other churches took longer. And then with the Second Vatican Council, with the very special relationship that Brother Roger had with Pope John the 23rd, and he was Pope from 1958 to 1963, that was a very special relationship. Both Brother Roger and Pope John lived with a childlike spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what they really had in common. No?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Jesus says, be like little children, the kingdom of God belongs to them. This was really the case. We knew the secretary of Pope John quite well.
Mm-hmm.
He lived to be very old. Pope, if I'm not mistaken, it was Pope Francis, Pope Benedict who made him a cardinal.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to know him and met him many times. And once when we met him, he told us about this spirit of childhood that Brother Roger had and that Pope John had. And then he quoted this famous French writer called Bernanos. Bernanos wrote many great novels.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere Bernanos says, a saint never loses the spirit of childhood. A saint never loses. He draws from this spirit of childhood, and it grows with him. This spirit of childhood grows with him as he fulfills his mission, as he accomplishes his mission.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think when Brother Roger and Pope John met the first time in 1958, something happened that opened up many doors for Brother Roger. He started to understand much more about the church, started to understand much more about that he had to be himself. And so that was an enormous, enormous gift to him. And then the council came, the Second Vatican Council, and there was a newly created Pontifical Council for Unity, and which invited Brother Roger on behalf of the Pope, of course, to be present as an observer at the council. And so from 1962 to 1965, Brother Roger went to all the different sessions of Vatican II. Every morning he was there in the Basilica of St. Peter. They would invite bishops to come and eat with the brothers in the evening and pray with them in the apartment in Rome, the apartment that we still have in the center of Rome. In those days, it was not expensive to live in the center of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
And many cardinals would come, many bishops, people writing the texts of Vatican II. They wanted to know what the brothers thought about the texts. Mm-hmm. So it was a different spirit. Instead of trying to contradict and say that the other person is wrong, you go to that person to try to how to write a better text. Mm-hmm. So these were very important years of the for the community. And you're right, something came to life then for the community. A hope of unity. And so when the council ended, December 1965, there was a very difficult moment for Brother Roger, because he saw that if there's no concrete expression of reconciliation, ecumenism, this search for unity, will maybe fall again. No? Mm-hmm. It will no longer be something popular. And that's exactly what happened. No? That's exactly what happened. And so, but also, that's when young people started coming to Tizé. Mm-hmm. In 66, young people started coming. And as Brother Roger opened the doors to welcome them, 67, 68, 69.
So Tizé became popular among young people through Second Vatican Council? Or
I wouldn't say like that, but I would say that what the council was not able to achieve, mm-hmm. Brother Roger thought, maybe the young people mm-hmm. will go further. And that's why he called it a council. At the beginning, it was called Council of Youth. Mm-hmm. In English, council... We have many councils. So you can have a town council, you can have a political council. But in French, concil, mm-hmm. concilium, concil, mm-hmm. it's a word that you use only for an assembly of bishops. Huh?
Yeah.
And so he called it a concil of youth, council of youth in the very solemn sense. Eh? Mm-hmm. And so he asked Pope Paul VI, is it a good idea? Pope Paul said, if you feel, Pope Paul trusted Brother Roger to a large mm-hmm. extent, he said, if you feel you must do it, no? Mm-hmm. And so in 1970, he announced there will be a council of youth that will be prepared for 4 years, and then it will open in 4 years' time. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got to know Tizé in those years when the council of youth was being prepared. Huh? Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of enthusiasm because, you know, today in our meeting in Ljubljana, you did this workshop on synodality. Mm-hmm. No? It, in a way, the council was all about that. No, mm-hmm. we all have a role. We all bring our vision. We all bring our dream. We all bring our gifts. No, and we sense that there's a church that is something. Yes, of course, it's God's gift, the church, but also it requires our participation. No, it mm-hmm. requires our bringing of all the gifts mm-hmm. that God has given us. And so, mm-hmm. so those were very exciting years. And so, I'm not the only one. Brothers who were there in 66 tell me this was very, very true. Brother Roger was a kind of sadness mm-hmm. and worried about the future. And then young people were there and he started to understand. Maybe it's young people that will help the church go further. Mm-hmm.
And you, when you came to Tizé was already full of young people, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So that's your question. And yeah.
Was this part of your vocation, actually, then?
Yeah.
You wanted, you felt in your heart that you want to spend time with young people, or was this not part of your vocation?
No, it was definitely part of my vocation. I felt I understood what the Council of Youth was about. Maybe it was presumptuous on my part, but I felt I understood what it was about. And I thought it was very exciting. That was very exciting because, you know, Brother Roger is not known as an academic. Mm-hmm. No, he's not. But actually, he had a very good knowledge mm-hmm. of church history, of what the church is and what the church is not. Mm-hmm. And so the very brief texts that were written to say, what is this council of youth going to be about? They are very profound texts that challenge culture. For example, I remember we all knew by heart in those years in 74, we all knew the texts that were preparing the council, but there were four sentences. The risen Christ is coming to bring alive, to quicken, we say in English. In French, we say animer une fête, to bring alive a spirit of festival, of joy, of mm-hmm. celebration. The risen Christ does this. Huh? Mm-hmm. He brings alive in each human being a spirit of festival. So there's this call to joy, mm-hmm. not just to analyze things, not just to be people who see problems, but to live in this spirit of celebration yeah. Of the risen Christ. Then the second sentence was, the risen Christ is preparing a springtime of the church, a church that is not going to be powerful, but it's going to be a servant, no? Mm. A servant in humanity. Third says it was about imagination. Mm. Very important word. No? The risen Christ gives us enough imagination
to make the vision. No?
Yeah, and to open up ways of reconciliation. Yeah. And the fourth one was more about giving our lives so that no one ever be a victim Again, not that human being never be a victim of another human being. So it's all that aspect of social justice and
peace.
Yeah, and so this I was introduced to today with that kind of text, and I thought it was very stimulating. And I realize even now, 50 years later, I realize how challenging that text was. Yeah. And it challenges culture, it challenges history, and it was a call to be creative.
Yeah. Mm. And then when we had this big New Year meetings, 100,000 people coming to Paris in 95, where I was also participating.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How did you feel? Was this spring which he talked about? Or?
Well, I remember the first European meeting I went to was 1978 in Paris. Mm-hmm. It wasn't so big. It was maybe 15,000 people.
Okay.
We were in Notre Dame, the beautiful Notre Dame Cathedral of Paris, and it wasn't big enough. So we had two other churches, Saint-Sulpice, and a third church, I think, Saint-Germain-des-Prés. And we connected them with a phone line. We didn't have much money, so we couldn't put all the modern equipment, but we could have at least an audio connection at a different church. The singing was independent, but when Brother Roger spoke, you could hear the three different churches. And I remember being in Paris, in Notre Dame, and in 1978, the church was full, and we prayed for the first time with songs of Désir. We did not have the songs before. In 78, we realized we have a prayer. We can pray with people who don't have a common language. We can pray with people who don't know anything about the church, who don't know anything about liturgy.
How did you pray before?
Before, it was in French with the psalms, with hymns, which were beautiful, which we liked, I still like to this day. But it did not make it possible for people of different languages to pray together. And so,
did you then sacrifice these beautiful psalms? Did you feel because you entered in one order and then it was totally different?
Yeah, to a degree, there was a little bit of a sacrifice because we realized if we're going to have people participate, we're going to have to simplify our way of prayer. And so Brother Roger could be quite radical, no? And so he was willing to sacrifice many things. And sometimes I think we went a little bit too far.
Mm-hmm.
And then we realized we went too far and we tried to balance again. We reintegrated certain things. Yeah. For example, after the reading in the morning, there's a very beautiful psalm. We reintegrated that.
You know, among my friends and me, always when we came to Tézé, we told each other, what is new? And in 19s, there were new halls, new buildings, and new barracks, and and always something new. Tézé is, for me, the symbol of church, which is always changing. How do you see, this is the last question, because we are already very long, how do you see this need, because you also wrote about Congar, who was speaking about the change and tradition.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you see this balance between tradition on one side and change on the other side? Because in Slovenia we have traditionalists who are for Latin Mass and so on, and then, for example, in Germany they have this LGBT church and everything, no?
Yeah.
How do you see we should discover this balance? What is important in this?
Well, it implies a deeper faith, I think, on our part, to see that what we are passing on, that's what tradition is, is the passing. So in English, sometimes we make of it a verb. It's not really a verb, but sometimes we say traditioning. It means passing on, passing on. And so what is passing on? What is making the mystery of Christ? That is what we are passing on. It's the mystery of Christ. What makes it alive in a culture that has changed, in a world that has changed? And so the only way to be faithful to something that is alive in a different context is to be creative. Otherwise, you're not faithful. You're just repeating. And so if I believe I'm a first century Christian, I believe Christ is the king of the universe, the cosmos. He is the firstborn of all creation, as St. Paul says. If I believe that, and then I live in a universe that is much bigger than what the first century thought about, how am I going to be faithful to what St. Paul is saying? I'm going to be faithful only if I can say things a little bit differently. So it's going to be the price of the condition of my faithfulness. And so that is a view of tradition that is very old, actually, very traditional. That's why I was so interested in the theologian Yves Congar, who later was made a cardinal by John Paul II, because he knew these things very, very well. Now, the only way you can be faithful sometimes to something is to say it in a different way.
Yes, okay. This is creativity. This is more on this innovation side of this spectrum. But on the other side, tradition, how much tradition to keep?
Yeah, but it's a little bit of a debate where you have to be clear on a tradition is not our old habits. Mm-hmm. Tradition is the mystery of Christ. Mm-hmm. That's what is being passed on. Mm-hmm. So that's why we distinguish between the plural traditions,
okay,
and tradition. So the tradition is really the passing on of this beautiful mystery of faith in Christ, mm-hmm. and that is always alive. It's not our old habits. Our old habits are interesting, you know. In our churches, we have, mm-hmm. and so it makes it a home. Kongau used to say it's a difference between an anonymous empty classroom and a home. No, mm-hmm. home. Wow, these are the family pictures. These are not. There's a warm atmosphere. So we have traditions, no, mm-hmm. that are part of. So we appreciate that sometimes, no, but that's not tradition. It's not the same as tradition, which is. Christ is alive today. There's mm-hmm. nothing greater, nothing more beautiful than the mystery of Christ. And mm-hmm. it has to be, if it's boring for you, mm-hmm. it's because I have not been a good mm-hmm. person of passing it on. I've been inadequate.
What would you then say, the last question? I have many more, but we can't afford. Yeah. What would you say to parents who want to and who are concerned if they will pass the religion further to their children? What is the most important?
I think that parents who have been through their life signs of God's goodness, of God's joy, of God's hope, of they have communicated something to their children, and that will maybe resurface mm-hmm. at moments later in life. There will be moments where maybe children abandon everything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if they have received a sense of God's goodness, of hope, and that's, you know, it's important that they receive that young, I think, mm-hmm. if it's possible. No. I had a professor once who taught me something about the early Christians, and he explained why in the early church they baptized children.
Yeah.
And some people thought, oh, it's because they were afraid that if the child died before baptism, the child would go to hell. Mm-hmm. But this professor said, no. He said, it's never too early to say to a child, you are made to be loved forever. Yeah. That is the meaning of it. Even if the child cannot understand it intellectually, no? Baptism, you are saying, you are a child of God. You are made to be loved forever. That is the meaning of your life. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Emil. I'm so honored to have you here in my podcast.
And it's a pleasure. Thank you.
I feel so blessed that I know you already now for 23 years, and I hope that I'll come to Next Silence and you'll be there again.
I hope so too. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.